Stephen Tobolowsky, he's probably been in every movie you've ever seen. At some point, he enters the movie at some point, you notice, that's Stephen Tobolowsky. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, there's this.
Phil Connors, I thought that was you.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for watching.
Hey. Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Not a chance.
Ned! Ryerson! Needle-nosed Ned the Head? Come on, buddy. Case Western High. Ned Ryerson, I did the whistling belly button trick at the high school talent show. Bing! Ned Ryerson got the shingles real bad senior year, almost didn't graduate. Bing! Again! Ned Ryerson, I dated your sister Mary Pat a couple times till you told me not to anymore. Well?
Ned Ryerson?
Bing!
Bing!
Here he is, Stephen Tobolowsky, ladies and gentlemen, from Seattle. How are you, Stephen?
I am doing very well. I'm in Seattle, as you mentioned now, and didn't you say there was some sort of human interaction kind
yes.
of thing going on? Am I missing that?
You can catch that. It's at the, what do they call it, Institute, the Talaris Institute there.
I think I'm headed for there when I finish with you.
Yeah.
I'm already having trouble here.
You'll need some human interaction after me, I think. It would be a change of pace. Now, Stephen, did you write that bit for the movie?
No. That bit was written, the bing, bing, bing bit was written for the movie. There was one piece I did write for the movie, though. Mm. This is a little bit of trivia.
Yeah.
And that is the last Ned scene in the movie where I come in and talk about all the different types of insurance that Bill Murray just bought for me. It was the greatest day of my life. That scene I did write for the movie because they had called me up and told me they wanted more Ned, but they hadn't written a scene yet. We were about to lose our location. So I just wrote that out quickly. I gave it to Bill. I gave it to Harold Ramis. We shot it, and that's my scene in the movie.
Yeah. How did you know that much about insurance? Did you have to research that? Or?
No, this is a little behind the scenes. People ask me how I came up with Ned, and I modeled some of it after my insurance man, Dennis. I remember when I finished, you know, Dennis was always trying to sell me insurance. When Groundhog Day came out, Dennis called me up on the phone and said, "Stephen, I got to tell you, I really loved your performance in the movie. I'm so tired of people making fun of insurance people. Finally, you showed us the way they really are."
Yeah, it was good. Classic movie. For one, I mean, that's in everyone's top 10, I think, of comedies. You think?
I think one of the greatest moments I had in my parenthood life was when my youngest son was 11. He had not seen Groundhog Day, and I said, "Well, you know, you ought to see Groundhog Day. I think you and your friends would enjoy it." And he said, "No, it sounds really boring, Dad, and you're in it, and that sounds kind of boring." I said, "Well, I know. Just put it in and watch it." So I left the room, and they put it in the machine, and to hear the laughter come from the room, from my kid and his friends, it did something to my, it was one of those moments as an actor you almost never have where you actually feel good.
Yeah, feel good about what you're doing. And what
feel
you're
good
doing.
About anything.
About anything.
Anything.
Yeah. Now, do you ever feel like, you know, geology, do you ever miss, you know, they think maybe you should have gone with the geology instead of the acting?
Oh, boy. No, I don't. I found when I was young, I loved rocks. And I thought that geology was where I wanted to go, and I studied geology, and I loved geology. But I've since then learned that it's just as difficult to be a working geologist as it is a working actor.
Really?
There really aren't that many jobs for you out there. So I'm glad I stuck with a comfortable line of unemployment.
Do you have to audition as a geologist, too? You have to go in for a seat, get a gig? Or?
You know, you got to audition for everything in this world. That's the one thing they don't teach you in college. You have to audition for I had to audition this morning to, like, get this coffee at Starbucks. It's so difficult.
It's got to be a problem. You walk into Starbucks and they're going to say, you know, the usual thing. Ned. Does that get tiresome?
I'm in an unusual place. I'm in Seattle, and so the negotiation, you know, I'm three... Where are you guys at? Are you in Wisconsin? Am I 2 or 3 hours different?
Madison, Wisconsin, yeah.
Madison, Wisconsin. Oh,
yeah.
So you're in the big city there.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's considerably earlier here, and so it was far more difficult to communicate with the Starbucks person as usual. But like you say, that seminar is coming up in human interaction, and if I hang over a little bit longer here in Seattle, we'll work out better tomorrow, I think.
Yeah. Now, when you go to school, you went to acting school, and was it SMU? Illinois is when you actually started the acting school, right?
Well, no, I did acting school at SMU.
Oh, you did as well.
In Dallas, Texas, and then I went to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is it actually hands-on and useful? I mean, obviously you learn acting techniques and so forth, but do they teach you how to audition, for example, and what you're going to have to go through emotionally?
It is completely useless. If there are any young actors out there in the sound of my voice and listening to your show, I found the problem with any acting school and the problem with college is that usually you work on things like Shakespeare, Chekhov, Shaw, Ibsen, Neil Simon. You work on pieces of material that make sense. And the authors that are trying to create those plays, those great classic plays, were trying to make a point and say something. When you audition for television or you audition for some movies, you're rarely working with material that makes sense at all.
Yeah, they don't ask you if you were in The Country Wife at a certain point?
No, they don't care if you were in The Country Wife. I worked on one script where I was Bill in the first part of the script, and I was Ted in the second part of the script. And they had rewritten the script and changed who I was, but they didn't go back through and change the name.
Yeah.
So, but this happens all the time. I remember...
Well, did you go with the Bill or the Ted in that instance?
I went with both. Okay. And I was doing the movie with Richard Crenna, and he used to call me Bill Ted. And... nobody caught on. Even the we would rehearse the scene, and he'd say, "Well, Bill Ted, tell me." And nobody figured it out. And then when we shot the scene, he would just say Bill because he thought that was a better name than Ted.
Yeah.
But I remember. Here's an example. I underwent that open heart surgery thing, which was a traumatic kind of a thing, but it was.
Sure.
A great thing. I mean, I've never felt better in my life. And there was a period of time where I couldn't work or couldn't get work. And so I sent an email out to all of my director-writer friends. Could you help me out? Is there anything that you could write that I could be in? And one, Rob Hedden, writer-director, said, "Stephen, I'm doing a movie now, and I've written a part for you." And he sent the script over to my house, and I was so excited. And I thought, you know, is it going to be Hamlet? Is it going to be Horatio? And I keep turning through the pages looking for my part. The part started on page 78. And it was the part of Butt Crack Plumber. And I'm thinking, he wrote this for me. He wrote it for me. I show up on the set, and the costume director says, "Well, could you get on your hands and knees? And could you stick your head under the sink?" And I hear him whispering to his assistant, saying, "Well, you know, I really don't see much crack. How did you get this part?" And I said, "You know, I knew the director." But you don't learn stuff like that when you're in college.
No, they should probably tell you that.
No.
Especially to get down on your hands and knees part. That could probably come in handy some of these.
Yeah, that comes in handy often.
Yeah, some of these auditions. Now, I have your, I think it's a partial list of what you've been in.
Yeah.
So can we go through it? It's only about 400 pages long. Let's start. Keep My Grave Open is your first credit, 1976. You were Robert.
Yeah. I played Robert the stable boy, and I was murdered with a samurai sword in the shower.
What a part, though. Huh? For your first part, that's great.
It was a great part, and I remember the director said he was going to shoot two versions. One version where I'm covered with blood in the shower, that would be the R-rated version, and then the version where they don't cover me with blood in the shower, and that would be the GP version. It was. You know, I think it's still available.
Yeah.
In England, it became kind of a cult film in England, and I think it's available on DVD or something there. Keep My Grave Open. Yeah. That was. I have hair in that one.
Okay, then we go to Cocaine and Blue Eyes, which is a TV movie. And was that the O.J. movie?
That was the one where I got to work with the inimitable O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
I played, in that one, I played a porno store clerk. if there are any young actors out there, you'll notice that there's a sort of hierarchy in Hollywood about when you have a name and when you don't have a name. If you have a good part, you usually have two names. Like Harrison Ford always has two names, like Richard Kimball. Johnny Depp always has two names, and even, you know, Captain Jack Sparrow. But then there's a hierarchy, lower than that, where you just get your name and the job profession.
Yeah.
And, like, if it's a comedy, I found out that you get your name and your first name and the job, like Sheriff Charlie, Ringmaster Bob. If it's a drama, you get your job profession and your last name, like Officer McLaren, that kind of thing, Father Donnelly, something like that.
Yeah.
If you go lower on the totem pole, you get things like porno store clerk. You don't have a name. You just have a job. And then it gets even worse than that if you get butt crack plumber. That gets to be anatomical parts and your job. That's really bad. But the interesting thing about Cocaine and Blue Eyes was we rehearsed that scene, and I met O.J. Simpson, who was incredibly charming.
Yeah.
This was before he was a multiple murderer or accused of that.
Yeah.
And we rehearsed the scene, but then we didn't shoot it for a long time, like a couple hours, and I didn't know what happened, what was going on. And they were rebuilding the floor in the porno shop so O.J. could be taller than I was.
Oh, yeah.
So they built a 2-inch ramp to where he could do the scene, and he was taller than I was, is what they were doing.
Well, you're 6'3"?
Yeah, I'm 6'3", and O.J. was probably about 6'1".
Yeah.
So, yeah, they built him up.
He did. So, didn't they ask you once if you could play 6'6"?
Yeah, that was bad. That was they don't teach you that in school either.
Yeah.
It was my first agent in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Said her name was Carol Farrell, and she said, "Stephen, I have a audition for you." This was like the first day I got her. I ran over there, and this was before the age of cell phones or before the age of fax machines or anything. So I ran over to get the material, and she said, "How tall are you?" And I said, "I'm 6'3". And she's looking at the character breakdown, and she said, "Can you be 6'6? And I said, "Well, with 3-inch heels, I could be 6'6.
Yeah.
It was to play the part of a basketball player. And that's when I realized that this agent may not be for me, because the rules, the physical laws of the universe didn't seem to apply to her.
Oh, yeah. But I notice here, in looking through this, it seems you get two names. You're Steve Comiskey and Knott's Landing. So that must have been sort of a breakthrough year for you.
Yeah, that was a difficult kind of a role. I went out to the wine country to do Knott's Landing, and before I was Steve Comiskey, I was Doctor. The role was Doctor, and I only had three words, it was one line with three little words, and so I have learned those three words. And then that morning, the director said, "Do you want to work on the part together?" And I said, "Well, no, it's okay. I think I've got it." And he says, "You've got it?" And I said, "Sure, I've got it. No problem." We arrive on the set, and I see everybody has different colored scripts than I do. And I don't know if your audience knows, but whenever there's a rewrite in Hollywood, they change the color of the pages so you know which version you're in. It's like a rock layer, stratified rock layer. I was working off of white pages. They were working off of green pages. And that's when they said, "Could we bring Steve Comiskey in?" And I'm just standing there, and everybody's looking at me, and they said, "You're on." And I'm going, "What?" I see that they have rewritten the script, and instead of my one line, I now have an entire scene filled with medical jargon, filled with all sorts of technical hospital data, subdural hematoma. We're going to do the, you know, the magnetic resonance imaging, all these kind of lines. And I felt like I was going to pass out, and the director said, do you not know the scene? I said, I've never seen the scene before in my life.
Yeah.
I said, give me 10 minutes and let me see what I can memorize, and then we'll shoot it. And boy, this was back in the age when I had a brain cell left.
Yeah.
So I actually learned the scene. It was like 3 or 4 pages of dialogue with medical jargon. I learned it in about 10 minutes. We shot all my stuff, and then I passed out.
Yeah. So, but you're a pretty quick study, right? I mean, to be a character actor, you pretty much have to be, right? I mean, a quick study and a good study. You got to know how to bring life to a character that has sort of limited, you know, screen time in a short space,
yes,
and really convey a lot about that character. So, but you're great at that.
Well, you have to know what kind of questions to ask. I remember once I was playing lawyer, right? Again, lawyer means nothing. Now, if I were a woman playing the same part, it would say lawyer attractive. So I was playing lawyer, and it was one of those, how do you play lawyer? Lawyer does not exist. I mean, are you a good lawyer, a bad lawyer? Are you the first person in your family that was ever received a graduate degree? Do you come from a long line of lawyers? You know, all sorts of detailed questions you could ask, but no, the writers say lawyer, which means nothing.
Yeah.
It just so happened that this biopic with Veronica Hamill, my lawyer was a real guy who lived in Texas, and he was still alive. So I called him up on the phone, and I felt it was indiscreet to ask if he was a good lawyer or a bad lawyer. But I did ask the first question. I said, did you always want to be a lawyer? And he said, oh, God, no. No, I always wanted to be a country western singer. He says, in fact, I have my guitar in my office, and while I interview people, I'm trying to write a country song. I hope to be in Nashville someday. So I go into the set the next day with my guitar, talk to the producer and director, and said, I have a new idea for lawyer. And so while I was doing my boring scene with Veronica, not that Veronica was boring or I was particularly boring, but the scene was, you know, just exposition, I started writing a country song there, and suddenly the scene came to life.
Yeah.
But it kind of underscores, if there are, again, any young actors out there in the sound of our voice, I have learned a lesson through hard experience, is that true always trumps clever.
Yeah.
So if you could find an element in your character that is true, it will be more important. Well, like Ned in Groundhog Day, of being able to find some elements from Dennis, my real insurance guy,
yeah,
that says, I'm telling the truth, even though Ned was a bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah. Now, I guess I'm a little surprised, maybe people are a little surprised, that you are given that little direction in terms of what your character is about in these movies. I mean, you have to bring the whole character to life yourself.
Yes. You have to do. Now, when you're Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
Or when you're Johnny Depp,
right?
All of those things are kind of in the script. In fact, you even often have to take a shower in the show if you're Harrison Ford or Johnny Depp. Or you have to drink coffee or eat breakfast. They have all of that stuff in the script, screen time.
Have you never taken a shower except a bloody one? Is that as a character?
I'm trying to think if on Californication, if I had to take a shower once. I don't think so, but
no.
I had to run around on my all together and on that show.
Yeah.
But as a character actor, you have to do all of that work on your own, and you have to be able to ask the right questions. And here's a question out there. If there are writers out there, which I know there are, who listen to you and again, actors, there's one question that I always ask that I always find is a great question and gets to the heart of the matter. And that is, what is my greatest hope and what is my greatest fear? Mm-hmm. If you could answer those two questions about your character, you could play anything from Romeo to Juliet.
Mm-hmm. From Romeo to Juliet.
Yeah, yes. Anything in between, too.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. The greatest hope and greatest fear. And so in the sense of you know the parameters of the character.
You take a look at like Ned Ryerson.
Yeah.
You know, Ned's greatest hope was that he was going to be an enormously successful life insurance agent. His greatest hope was that he would be enormously successful at what he would do. His greatest fear was that he was an outcast in high school and he had no friends.
Right.
So in all of my interactions with Bill Murray, I am trying desperately to engage him and desperately be his friend. That all came from greatest hope and greatest fear.
That's really amazing. And this is what you taught yourself, basically. You learned yourself.
And I had a great, boy, it's hard to say he was a great acting teacher. He was such a monster at times. At the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. Ed K. Martin was a pretty brutal guy at times, but he turned out to be an incredibly decent and truthful man. And he had some great insights into acting, and that was one of his. Greatest hope and greatest fear I learned from Ed. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be true. He turned out to be a dear, dear friend and supporter later on when I wasn't in school anymore. And he passed away, he passed away about 20 years ago now, but I still remember him, and everybody who took classes from Ed remember him too. I run into people who took classes from Ed all the time. He left his mark in the world.
Yeah. Was that the class where you had to do one art form in another art form?
No. No,
that was different. No.
That was different. Yeah, that was a visualization.
Visualization.
In class, when you were in college, you do a lot of classes that are meaningless. But when you're in graduate school, you do tons of classes that are meaningless. And this one class we had to do was called visualization.
Right.
And that's where you had to see an art form on Thursday, like go to the art museum and see a picture, and then you had to translate that art form into another art form on Tuesday. Well, you know, this is total BS because nobody is going to go see a painting on Thursday and write a symphony for Tuesday. They're not going to write a novel. What they're going to do is they're going to come up with some kind of street theater demonstration of something that's totally useless in any application. So what I did, we on Thursday we went to see a Zen painting. It was of a monk sitting on a mountaintop with a vast amount of open sky above him. So I told the entire class they had to go out and wait in the coffee area till I set up the classroom for my demonstration. So they all left with giggling anticipation because they knew I was going to come up with something really, really funny. So they left. I went in. I took off all of my clothes. I put my underwear in my pants. I put my socks in my shoes. I sat my clothes at my desk and wrote on a piece of paper, "This too will pass." Then from the paper bag I had, I pulled out a bathrobe, put it on, snuck out of the room, went downstairs to the dressing rooms where I had another set of clothing, and I walked home. So I left them all at the coffee place. Now, the report I got back was that after 20 minutes, Bernard Hobgood, our teacher, was getting a little antsy that my setup was taking too long. After 40 minutes, he was furious and came marching down with the entire class pounding on the door saying, "Stephen, enough of this. It's gone on too long. It's gone on too long." And finally he burst through the door, and there he was greeted with the me and my underwear and my socks with the little sign on the desk saying, "This too will pass." And that was my visualization. I was at home at that time drinking a Rolling Rock beer, watching Ironsides on TV. That was my Zen demonstration for the class.
And eating a steak biscuit, probably, at that point.
Eating an Ireland steak and biscuits. Yes. Yeah.
Stephen, it's been a joy talking with you. I wish we had more time to do it. And I know things are going on right now. What are you doing right now? I read that you're working on Californication. I know.
Californication. I just did Justified, which is a fabulous. Well, both Californication and Justified are just fabulous shows. One is violent and one is very sexual, but if you're not squeamish, they're both really great. I'm still involved with the book tour for the Dangerous Animals Club. So I'm in Seattle tonight. I'm doing a book signing and a Groundhog Day event. And then next week I'm in Dallas and then New York. And what I do is I'll do stories live and then do a book signing. And I believe we're going to be recording some more stories for PRI, which is enormously exciting.
Yeah.
And that'll be coming to hopefully a station near everybody.
Yes, near you. The Dangerous Animals Club is the book. Stephen Tobolowsky. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you so much.
Been a great pleasure. I love it.